Blog Talk Radio.
Rick Spezak, News Director of Progressive News Network. How are you tonight? We've got an exciting show for you with a really wonderful lineup. We've got Rebecca Marquez of Oceana. We've got the comedian and dramatic actress Franny Sheridan, author, composer Lillian Stombacher. We've got Beatrice Malnick from Brazilian Voices and political comedian Lee Camp. So I'm glad you joined us. Let me start right away with the news. The president has come out with a budget that many Democrats are quite concerned about the thrust of it. And let me play this quick clip from Congressman Raul Grijalva. Here we go.
Arizona Representative Raul Grijalva is co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus.
Quite frankly, Social Security did not cause a deficit. It should be a separate discussion away from this whole budget issue. It has been a trophy the Republicans have won.
And ABC cut him off there. So, listen, more news ahead. Senator Elizabeth Warren has continued to find out what the heck's going on with the regulators and why is it that they're regulating information flowing to the public. So here's Senator Warren asking some questions of another hapless regulator.
Let me just make sure I understand this completely. I want to know on a bank-by-bank basis the number of families that were illegally foreclosed on. Will you give me that information?
Eventually, we are going to issue a statement to the public where we provide additional information, but if we go through the processes that I described previously, we can share it to Congress in its oversight capacity.
So you're saying you will make that information publicly available?
I did not say that. I said that we're planning on issuing a public statement that wraps up the IFR and
that's
provides
not
additional
what I'm
information.
Asking for.
Yeah.
What I'm asking for is a bank-by-bank analysis of how many families they illegally foreclosed on. Will you give us that information?
We can provide that to Congress in its oversight capacity if we go through the normal processes that we're prepared to follow.
And why are you not making that public? I just want to make sure I understand.
I don't know there's been a decision not to. I think that we're still evaluating what
we're
going to release publicly.
Are you claiming that the information about illegal activity is privileged and confidential?
It's all part of it is all confidential supervisory information, but that does not mean that we won't at some point release some of that information. That decision just hasn't been made at this point.
So you're saying when you find evidence of illegal activities by the banks, when they have illegally foreclosed against homeowners, that information is privileged and you will not release it without a letter from Congress?
If it is derived from the bank examination process, yes, it is.
How else would you get it?
Well, sometimes you get information through third parties, through outside sources, but in this case, that's not
the case. Unless someone throws a rock through the window with this information tied to it, you will not release it? Is that what you're saying?
To the extent that the information is confidential supervisory information derived from the exam process, it is subject to privilege. We don't ordinarily make that public. However, in this case, we do plan on making public issuances describing further findings and further analysis of the process.
On a bank-by-bank basis of illegal activity.
I don't know if that's been determined yet.
All right, so let me ask it from the other point of view. You now have evidence in your files of illegal activity, I take it, for some of these banks. I get that from the evidence you've released about the charts, who's going to get paid what. So if someone believes that they have been illegally foreclosed against, will they still have a right under this settlement to bring a lawsuit against the bank?
Yes.
All right. Now, if a family wants to bring the lawsuit, you're both lawyers, would it be helpful, if you're going against one of these big banks, would it be helpful for these families to have the information about their case that's in your files? Mr. Yes. Ashton?
It would be helpful, obviously, to have information related to the injury. Yes, it would.
Okay. So do you plan to give the families this information? That is, those families that have been victims of illegal foreclosures, will you be giving them the information that's in your possession about how the banks illegally foreclosed against them? Mr. Ashton?
I think that's a decision that we're still considering. We haven't made a final decision yet.
So you have made a decision to protect the banks, but not a decision to tell the families who were illegally foreclosed against?
We haven't made a decision about what information we would provide to individuals. That's true, yes.
Mr. Stepana?
We're in the same position.
So I just want to make sure I get this straight. Families get pennies on the dollar in this settlement for having been the victims of illegal activities or mistakes in the bank's activities. You let the banks, and you now know individual cases where the banks violated the law, and you're not going to tell the homeowners, or at least it's not clear yet whether or not you're going to do that.
We haven't made a decision on what we're going to tell the homeowners.
You know, I just have to say, I thought this was about transparency. That's what this is all about. People want to know that their regulators are watching out for the American public, not for the banks. And the only way that we can evaluate whether or not you're doing your job is if you make some of this information publicly available. And so far, you're not doing that. And without transparency, we can't have any confidence either in your oversight or that the markets are functioning properly at all. So, and that people are going to receive proper compensation for what went wrong.
That was Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren, questioning bank regulators on whether they're going to release information to the public about when banks behaved illegally and took their homes, a matter obviously of some concern to Senator Warren, regardless of whether it was concern to the bank's regulators or not. These news stories, the war on whistleblowers heats up. President Obama came to office promising government transparency and accountability, but throughout his presidency he's acted more aggressive than any other president to silence government whistleblowers who might expose corruption, fraud, and general wrongdoing. Since 2009, Obama has used the World War I era Espionage Act 6 times to prosecute government officials suspected of leaking classified information. A Bloomberg report on this intimidation campaign summarized the objective this way: the president's crackdown chills dissident, curtails a free press, and betrays Obama's initial promise to usher in a new era of open government. The logic behind the prosecution of whistleblowers is that a government has a right to protect itself and its own best interests, and as a result, should be allowed to punish treasonous citizens. Woodrow Wilson argued the Espionage Act allowed the government to protect itself against insidious methods of internal hostile activities and declared it unlawful at a time of war to publish information that the government might determine to be of such a character that it is or might be useful to the enemy. Following this logic, it seemed reasonable that Obama would crack down on whistleblowers. The problem, though, Glenn Grenwald of The Guardian wrote, is that the Obama whistleblower war has nothing to do with national security. It has nothing to do with punishing those who harm the country with espionage or treason. It has everything to do with destroying those who expose high government wrongdoing. It's particularly devoted to preserving the government's ability to abuse its power in secret by intimidating and deterring future acts of whistleblowing and impeding investigative journalism. Greenwald makes an important point. The common thread between the cases of every whistleblower who's been prosecuted since 2009 is the growing strain of witnessing acts of fraud, corruption, and flagrant unconstitutionality. Four whistleblowers from the National Security Agency, the NSA-4, all echo the struggle of being asked to hold classified information that is clearly in violation of the law. Thomas Drake, William Burney, J. Kirk Webb, and Edward Loomis make up the NSA-4, who who were falsely accused of leaking confidential information in 2007. According to The Nation, the NSA4 have now endured years of harassment for exposing the waste and fraud behind a multi-billion dollar contract for a system called Trailblazer, which was supposed to revolutionize the way the NSA produced signals intelligence in the digital age. By the way, the issue of nuclear waste isn't a new one. It's been around for a long time. It seems that there's World War II waste dumped all over the place. German journalists have discovered barrels of radioactive waste on the floor of the English Channel. It's previously thought that that material had just dissipated. You know, boop, disappeared. A new investigative report from a joint French-German public broadcaster, Arte, has concluded the waste is still intact at the bottom of the sea. German public broadcaster, SWR, discovered two nuclear waste barrels at a depth of 124 meters, that's 406 feet, just kilometers from the French coast. The British barrels are estimated to have contained 58 trillion becquerels, units of radioactivity, while the Belgian barrels held some 2.4 trillion becquerels. TEPCO, in another nuclear story, faces a decision to dump radioactive water into the Pacific. Well, there's enough time for that. We have to go on to our first live guest. Let me bring on Miss Rebecca from Oceania. Welcome.
Hi, Rick. How are you doing today?
Very good. Very good. I understand there's big news from Oceania.
Oh, yes. I'm really excited to be on here again. Thank you so much for having us.
Our pleasure.
As a whole. Well, as you know, of course, we are creeping right now up until April 20th, which is going to be almost hard to believe, the third anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf.
But Rebecca, didn't that all just magically disappear?
I think that's the commercials that they're running on TV. Unfortunately, it's not the case, as I'm sure you know. I wish it would have honestly disappeared with offshore drilling in its entirety. But unfortunately, while we're still cleaning it up nearly 3 years later, we're already looking to expand offshore drilling. And it's not being called that because it's going to be the first step of it, which is seismic air gun testing. So right now, President Obama is considering taking the first step towards offshore drilling in the Atlantic coast. And it's actually going to be running from Delaware all the way to Central Florida. And the really horrible thing about seismic air gun testing is not only, Rick, is it the first step to offshore drilling, but it's also dangerous in itself. It's dangerous to dolphins and other marine life to live off our coast. And even with the government's own estimates, seismic air gun testing in the Atlantic is estimated to injure or possibly kill 138,500 dolphins and whales, which is really horrible, including endangered right whales. The North Atlantic right whale is right now only estimated to be at about 500 individuals left, and it's critically going to injure or possibly kill 9 of those remaining 500. And it's going to be right in the breeding ground of that area, which is the really horrifying part of it. And the really exciting news of this all is that, you know, here in Florida, we remember the BP oil spill, I think, better than the rest of the country for obvious reasons. And the good news about that is that people here haven't forgotten. And we've actually set up right now for the third anniversary within a week's time from starting Wednesday in Orlando, going up until Saturday on the actual anniversary itself, 5 different events already. We'll have Florida in Orlando, Jacksonville, Tampa, Miami, and Miami Beach. So that's exciting news, Rick, is that really all across Florida, we have found people in, you know, a couple months' time that are just like, hey, we'll stand with you. What do you need us to do? So we'll be running huge events, mixing mock oil spill as well as mock seismic air gun testing. Because we can't, of course, you know, mimic the exact noise of seismic air gun testing because it's so much louder than even a jet engine. But we'll be giving people a little bit of that taste with air horns and really fun vuvuzelas. Have you ever heard of a vuvuzela? Rick?
No,
chance?
No, I haven't.
I'm a soccer fan, so I was really excited to incorporate these into our vents.
Oh, okay, those big horns.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Exactly. If you ever caught a soccer game and try to put it on mute, those are the reasons for it. So, well, you know, and I think that's the part of the vent that I really think is going to speak to people, because, you know, we're going to be giving people a little bit of a taste of what these animals and whole marine life are going to have to go through on a very small scale. And we're really hoping it's going to make a huge effect on how they see the disruption of these entire ecosystems. And so we're really excited to do that, and we're really excited to tie it in to offshore drilling. Because I believe we've talked about this before, that when I first started working here, you know, I really didn't know what seismic aggregate testing was. And it sounded like, you know, very scary idea to me. Seismic aggregate testing is a lot of words. And it's not something that triggers off any immediate memory to most people. Our biggest problem is really getting that message across of what is seismic aggregate testing and what is it going to lead to do. So we believe with all these events, we're going to get that message out really loud and really clear to everybody that seismic aggregate testing is unnecessary and it's dangerous, as is offshore drilling, as you can imagine. So what better time to do that, you know, on the third anniversary?
Sure.
In Florida.
Rebecca, is there information on your website about how that process works and what's actually involved?
Absolutely. If you go to oceana.org, there's actually a whole section that we put up fairly new on seismic aggregate testing explicitly. And again, it's oceana.org. And it'll be under the offshore drilling section, and there will be a whole section on seismic aggregate testing, or you can just Google Oceana and seismic aggregate testing. And there's plenty of information that we're getting out. And that's been the good part, is that, you know, we were expecting to hear about this decision from the Department of Interior, at least, a recommended proposal to President Obama. We were expecting to have this all the way last year. You know, it wasn't looking good. A whole bunch of representatives have signed on to President Obama, encouraging him to initiate seismic aggregate testing. So, luckily, the Department of Interior has moved back their overall environmental impact statement. The final will be coming out at some point this year, probably in fall, which has given us more time to get out the information to people about what seismic aggregate testing is and what it's really going to do. And, you know, the reason why that's so critical is because here in Florida, especially, you know, we're still cleaning up the spill, of course. And overall, Florida boasts 300,000 jobs and tourism and recreation, and 100,000 jobs in commercial fishing alone. So what that will do to Florida's economy in the name of, you know, big oil is just really upsetting and angering, because what does Florida have to lose? I mean, what does Florida have to gain? We have everything to lose. Is seismic aggregate testing is expanded and offshore drilling is okayed off of our East Coast now, when we're still cleaning up the mess in the Gulf. So the good news about this is, like I said, we've had some more time because they've delayed the environmental impact statement. And now what we can do is continue to reach out to volunteers, continue to reach out to coalition partners. You know, I got off the phone the other day with a really great local activist down here that called me by mistake. he didn't mean to call me, and we started chatting of just, what are you all working on? What am I working on? And I said, you know, we're still working on seismic aggregate testing. That's our main focus. And he said, what do you mean, seismic aggregate testing? And I was like, seismic aggregate testing. I started explaining what seismic aggregate testing was. And he said, no. I know what seismic aggregate testing is. Do you mean there's something being proposed to happen on our Atlantic coast? And I said, absolutely. And we got talking, and he's actually going to be one of our speakers at one of our events. And that's the kind of, you know, across the aisle, working with other groups that we're getting a chance to do only because it's been pushed back. And we're hoping that every month that goes by, we can only get out our message more and really focus on how this is going to affect Florida and the whole East Coast, because this is going to run from Delaware all the way to Central Florida. So the good news about that is, again, is that we have had time to also get representatives on our side and to write President Obama to express their wishes that seismic irrigant testing is not allowed to happen, and that we effectively, immediately stop the pursuit of looking for oil and gas exploration in any kind of way off our East Coast. And here in Florida, Representative Alcee Hastings recently actually led a letter to President Obama representing Florida. And another good news about this is that, you know, sometimes it's easy to think that this is, blue or red issue, but it's really not. You know, the health of our oceans is a nonpartisan. It really is. And the health of our environment as a whole. And what's encouraging about that is that Representative Ileana Rosleinen is a Republican down here, and Representative Alcee Hastings is a Democrat. She co-signed his letter to President Obama against seismic irrigant testing. And that's the kind of thing that should be really applauded, and we need more of that. We need more across the aisle people working on both sides to stand up for environment, stand up for our local businesses, because you know, these are local families and local businesses that have been around here, you know, for ages that are going to get really hurt by this. Small fisheries, you know, and small tourism organizations like restaurants and beach towns that depend on the health of our oceans for them to survive. And so this is not only just an endangerment to the animals, it's also an endangerment to many in our community. And that's the thing that we're, again, hopefully with these events, going to reach out all across Florida. We're hoping to get in every major city in Florida by the time September comes. So hopefully we can really travel across the state and get everybody out in the streets blowing a vuvuzela with us and standing next to a mock oil spill to get people going and to tell their representatives to let President Obama know before it's too late.
Do I understand from your comments that they're still looking for public input?
Oh, absolutely.
Where should they go to give the administration their feedback?
Well, the best way is always there's a couple different ways, and this is the really exciting thing about I believe in activism is that there's really an umbrella of ways that you can communicate your message and ways to be effective. So the way we're looking at this is in a couple different ways. One, we believe every single person's voice being heard in any kind of way. Again, like I said, the part about seismic irrigant testing that I think is really our uphill battle is that a lot of people don't know what it is. And a lot of people aren't aware that it's going on. So even, you know, following us on Facebook, our local page is Oceana Florida. Our main page is Oceana on Facebook or Twitter, and even that social media, letting your voice heard and retweeting things and passing along information is absolutely great. Another way is that we will soon, about this week, have a national petition that you can also find on our website. So I would ask people to please check back with you, and we'll be releasing a lot of information about that. But we're going to have a national petition that we're really hoping to get some really good backers behind and really get this message clear and across. And another way, of course, is always visiting your local representative. I can't elaborate how effective a constituent visit to the representative is. I mean, it gets frustrating, Rick, and sometimes it doesn't always, you know, it doesn't always run in your favor, and I don't want to make that sound like one visit is going to change anybody's heart.
Well, they're there to serve us, aren't they?
Yes, and that's the most important part, I think, is letting them know that you're there, and they're serving you, they're working for you. So that's my favorite part as a U.S. citizen, is knowing that they can never close their office door on me. because they're technically working for you.
That's
and,
right.
You know, absolutely. And I think that gets lost, and you know, because it's not always just an easy win. But even the ones that I don't think I can, that you know, you may not influence, I still think it's important for them to know that you're still one of their constituents, and you're still there, and this is something they should know about. But one thing, you know, I definitely believe in the power of it for, is because we had a couple of volunteers here go over to Representative Ileana Rosalina's office, and they sat down with their staff, and they got passed through to D.C. in one visit, just with, you know, some information about seismic air gun testing. And just from that one visit, about 2 weeks later, they sent a letter. She reaffirmed her opposition to offshore drilling. And within a day, the next day that Representative Alcee Hastings issued his letter and asked other representatives to sign on, she signed on to it.
Excellent.
And there's no doubt in my mind, yeah. There's no doubt in my mind that, sorry.
Something else I was thinking, and you know, you may agree with me on this, not everybody is aware that dolphins and whales are dependent on reading feedback from their own sonar communications.
Absolutely.
And just like a person who's dependent on hearing to know where they are, if you blast out their hearing and make their receptor, shall we say, you know, deaf to sonar, it's not just a matter that they're not going to hear. It means that they can't navigate, they can't
exactly.
hunt, they can't eat. And I think, you know, not everybody may know this. Why don't you go ahead and explain that sonic air gun? Because, you know, a lot of people might think, well, an air gun, well, at least they're not shooting things. Well, it's not about what they're shooting. It's about the fact that the pressure coming from that, which is pressure that's so great that it's literally putting sound waves, putting pressure waves down into the rock, down
Absolutely.
Into the seafloor, so that pockets of oil can be detected by these intense pressure waves. So I'm afraid, in a sense, that when we describe it as, well, it's a sonic air gun, you know, people who don't understand the nuance of that might not imagine
Absolutely.
That what we're essentially doing is screaming so loud that the earth is ringing.
I think you hit the nail on the head with that. It absolutely is devastating to these animals because, and to go off of that of how loud this is 100,000 times more intense than a jet engine. I mean, I can't even fathom that. I'm saying that to you. I'm saying that number to you because that's the truth of it. But I couldn't even fathom what could possibly feel like 100,000 times louder than a jet engine.
I happen to have been a sound engineer at one part of my life, and the jet engine test was 120 dBs of sound. So if
yeah.
you've been in a discotheque and you felt your internal organs moving back and forth, that's probably about jet engine. Now you say they're using 100,000 times more profound than that?
More intense, yes. And the reason why is because it has to be comparable to dynamite.
Yeah.
And then you think about it, and sound can travel hundreds to thousands of miles across an ocean and impact waters way outside the direct testing zone. And not only is that noise so loud that it can do that, to like fathom that, of it being this loud to get all this done and to go outside and reach outside of the direct testing zone, but it's going to happen every 10 seconds for 24 hours to sometimes weeks on end in just one area alone. And when you think of that disruption and you think about the stress levels of these animals, and all the stress and pain that they're going to go to. And you know, we say injure at least in a minimum because it will injure them, or kill because, you know, we're saying that because we'd be irresponsible to say absolutely all those animals. But, of course, this is a huge, huge disruption to their most important daily lives and behaviors, like their sonar. And that's what's really troubling about this. It's not that, you know, I mean, there's so many layers to be troubled about the possibility of seismic aerogen testing. You know, you have the possibility and really the push to search for new waters to perform offshore drilling in. And then you're just thinking of the manner in which we're doing this. You know, in 2008, when they did this in Madagascar, dozens of melon-headed whales beached themselves and died following seismic aerogen testing by ExxonMobil. And then, not too long ago, last year in Peru, about 900 long-beaked dolphins and black porpoises died after seismic aerogen testing. And those are the numbers, and those are the experiences that you have to take in consideration when we're talking about this, because those are the only ones, those are the ones that beach themselves. Those are the ones we know. And we're talking about doing this not just in one area. We're talking about the entire stretch from Delaware to Central Florida. Imagine the pronounced effects that that's going to have, and it'll just be absolutely devastating. It's not only these really intelligent marine life like dolphins and whales, but also the fisheries, the communities of fishes, that their whole pattern is going to be disrupted. And that's what's really worrisome, is there's so many layers of this issue which are just really troubling and should really reach out to everybody. And that's what we're trying to do. That's why we're going out here doing the events, because you have experience in all these aspects. You know about seismic aerogen testing. You know about noise levels. The average person doesn't know that, Rick, you know.
And unfortunately, they're probably not aware that the dolphins and porpoises and whales are generally regarded by those that study them as having, if not the same, greater intelligence than we humans have. And it's such a crime against nature to do this. What's that current buzz phrase for the energy? We're going to do everything's on the table, or how is that
all
go?
All of the above. Oh, that was the catchphrase for sure.
Yeah. It reminds me of that other environmental catchphrase, no imminent danger.
Yeah. it's frustrating to hear that, because it's totally irresponsible to say, first of all. And then on top of it, I mean, do we really need to go into further why we don't need offshore drilling? It's dirty, it's dangerous, and it's unnecessary, and we've seen what it can do. And we're still recovering from what we can do. How irresponsible is it for someone to say that in 3 years, deep water oil drilling is somehow safer?
Well, it's not.
It's not. Exactly.
And of course, go ahead.
Oh, no. It's one of those things that, you know, you really have to understand that there's not that many people that say that. And that's really my belief. There's very few people who really think we should be drilling off of our Atlantic coast and we should be exploring that. There's very few people that I think are opposed to clean, renewable energy like offshore wind. And the reason why it doesn't feel like that always is because they're not heard and they're not 100% active. And that's what we're really trying to do with these events. Like I said, if you look at where we're going, we're really going all across all Florida. We're looking to get a sixth event in Panhandle.
Why don't you read those event days and locations again for the audience?
Okay, great. So the first event that is coming up will be in Orlando, Florida. And that'll be actually this Wednesday. So we're kicking off things right in the middle of the week. And it'll be at University of Central Florida at 10 a.m. And we have a Facebook event page that people can find out this information as well. And we have contact information if someone wants to meet someone there. And the event page is called 2010 Never Again. And, well, one, I think that has a nice little ring to it.
Sure.
But also... I hope it really drives home that message. That will be right on campus. Of course, it's right in the free speech zone, and we have tons of volunteers out there willing to help people get to it. The next event that we'll be having will be actually in Miami, and it will be at Florida International University, right in the main campus in Dade County. And I can be a contact for that as well. My email is rmarquez@oceana.org. I can be, and if anyone needs ever to contact me, they can always email me there. And I can set you up directly with your local event. And then we're going to have three all in the same day on April 20th, which is really exciting. And we're going to be in Tampa, you know, right all the way on that coast, April 20th, 11 a.m. at the University of South Florida. And then Jacksonville, which is fantastic because it's going to be in the blast zone. And so it's really important for us to get all of those areas because, I mean, it still impacts a huge part of Florida, all the way down to Central Florida, a little bit further down past Daytona. But, you know, we have to remember this is really going to impact the Northeast primarily. So that's what I think is amazing about all the events we're doing, is that if you notice, many of these events many of these cities and locations weren't affected by the oil spill, or
right.
might not be affected by seismic air gun testing.
Right.
And this leads me to believe that we just have a whole bunch of people that believe that Florida doesn't need seismic air gun testing, and we don't need offshore drilling. And then on April 20th again, our Vanguard event is going to be right there on Miami Beach. I'll be leading that. Welcome to come out if you have the time. It's going to be on South Beach. We're going to be right on the beach next to the entrance of 15th Street.
Okay.
And you're not going to be able to miss us because we got our tent, we got our table. We'll have a huge mock oil spill demonstration going on with people in hazmat suits. It's going to be a great time. We'll be making plenty of noise with vuvuzelas and air horns. And also Jackie Ayala from Southern Energy Network will be joining us, and Matt Schwartz from South Florida Wildlife
sure.
Will be joining us. And we'll also have some Spanish statements to get non-English speakers involved because that's been a huge area. I am Hispanic myself, and I can tell you that many, especially South Americans and other Central Americans, really believe in environmental causes. And I believe that, you know, us uniting with a whole vast different and, you know, diversifying our movement, especially down here in Florida, is so important, can only help us and make us stronger.
Absolutely.
We will be having a statement read in Spanish, and looking forward to it. It's going to be a really great time.
Well, thank you so much, Rebecca, for joining us. The work that you do is so important. I want to ask you one last thing, and just keep it in your box for later reference. I'm sure there's got to be some kind of annual health of the seas or health of the ocean conference. Please keep us aware when you hear about that, okay? Because we'd like to try to get that out there. People need to realize, even if you're not an avid swimmer, if you're not an avid seafood eater, the oceans are paramount to life on land. We
Absolutely.
Can ill afford to mistreat them, and we do our all beings of great disservice if we are casual in how we treat the cetaceans, the whales and dolphins. It's a real shame. Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you so much. Give your website one more time.
www.oceana.org. And thank you again so much for having me on.
Oh, you're very welcome. Come back anytime.
Have a great day, Rick.
Okay, bye-bye. That was Rebecca Marquez of Oceana. Make sure you get involved. Support them. You heard the events will be starting on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Make sure you help. Make sure you participate. The oceans were there for us. We need to be there for the oceans. And our brothers and sisters, the dolphins and whales, they need our protection from these people who are so cavalier and would destroy so much of sea life. Before we start our next segment, I do want to mention that you should support all our good friends, the progressive community. There's a great selection of progressive broadcasters out there. I want to mention our good friend Gwen Holden Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters. I want to mention Anita Stewart and her Wise Women show, Susan Nylon and the Nylon Report, Brian Stetton and his show, Progress Toward Democracy, and also our friend Sita Begul up in the Melbourne area with her program. So these are great broadcasters. Oh, and our, of course, our friend Harriet Lerman and her show Voice of the People. So make sure you tune in. This is our art show, but before we get our next artist on, I do want to do at least one more news story. These are very important for us. Let's see here. Here we go. not ruled out. Officials at the utility known as TEPCO, including President Naomi Hirose, have said the company won't easily release radiated water into the ocean, indicating that it's not ruling out the possibility of that either as they run out of storage. The utility plans to have 450,000 tons of above-ground tank capacity at the end of September and 700,000 tons by mid-2015, Japan's trade ministry said in a statement. It's obvious that TEPCO cannot keep storing water forever as it increases by 400 tons a day, said Hiyoki Ban, co-director of the anti-nuclear group Citizens Nuclear Information Center. That's why the company won't rule out the discharge into the sea, Ben said in a telephone interview. TEPCO has had leaks of radioactive water at the plant before. In April of last year, it said as much as 12 tons of radioactive water had leaked from a pipe and may have poured into the sea. That followed a leak at the same pipeline 11 days later. Radiation amount? Yesterday, TEPCO reported another leak of radiated water, this time from a pipe. Reports differ on how much radiation escaped from the Fukushima plant, with TEPCO in May last year estimating it was about 70% of that released from the 1986 nuclear accident at Chernobyl. 2011, the Atmospheric Chemistry and Physics Journal estimated the radiation release at about 42% of Chernobyl, and that most of it fell into the North Pacific Ocean. The same month, the Institute for Radiological Protection and Nuclear Safety, which is funded by the French government, said the Fukushima plant was responsible for the biggest discharge of radioactive material into the ocean in history. And that was as of then. Next month, the United Nations Scientific Committee of Effects of Atomic Radiation, or UNSCLEAR, is expected to issue the first global and independent assessment of the Fukushima nuclear accident, including how much radiation was released, where it went, according to the website. Oh, by the way, next week is going to be our nuclear show. Make sure you tune in. A fisherman fear. Human exposure to radiation is moderate to high levels can lead to cancer, such as leukemia, according to UNSCLEAR. Pacific blue tuna caught off San Diego in August 2011 was found to contain radioactive cesium 10 times higher than the fish seized in previous years. Researchers including Daniel Madigan and Nicholas Fisher said last May, radiation levels, which the group said don't pose a danger to the public, are expected to decline over time, they said in a study at that time. Fishermen fear more people would hesitate to buy fish and shellfish caught off Fukushima if TEPCO releases radioactive water into the ocean, said Kanji Nakata, an official of the Fukushima Prefecture's Federation of Fisheries Company. We're against the release of water even if TEPCO cleans contaminated water by removing radioactive substances, Nakata said in a phone interview. Any release of water that has been issued for cooling is not acceptable. On March 30th, TEPCO started test runs of equipment that the operator says can remove 62 kinds of radioactive substances. Still, the purification system called ALPS can't remove tritium, a hydrogen isotope. The water processing system has also had problems and was temporarily halted last week because of incorrect operation. Yeah, you know what that means, don't you? Okay, let's see. The government will set up a special committee to discuss measurements to help TEPCO deal with radioactive water at Daiichi, the Trade and Industry Ministry said in a statement today. When we reach a stage where the water contains no radioactive substances after removing tritium, we will properly handle it, Hakatayama said. We haven't decided whether the water will be released into the sea after that. Leaking pits. Currently, about 280,000 tons of highly radioactive water is stored at the Fukushima plant, according to TEPCO's latest data. That's enough to fill about 112 Olympic-sized swimming pools, according to the Bloomberg News calculation. To store that water, TEPCO dug underground pits lined with three layers of waterproof sheet to prevent seepage into the surrounding soil, according to the utility. The same method is used in industrial waste disposal, said Koji Komaji, a geotechnical engineer professor at Hachinohe Institute of Technology. The design flaw is likely to have caused the leaks if the method is used around the world, Komaji said in a phone interview. The question is whether TEPCO properly inspected equipment and carried out tests before pouring radioactive water into the pits. It's the pits, ladies and gentlemen. It's the pits. Rainy season. TEPCO is still investigating the cause of leaks. And I think we've got our next guest on there, so let me play the intro music. Here we go, ladies and gentlemen.
One, two, three, come with me, up, and you'll be up in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin now with a spin, traveling in a world of my creation. What we'll see will defy explanation.
If you want to view paradise, simply look around and
view it. Oh,
anything you want to
do, what do
want to change your world, there's nothing to it.
And ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Franny Sheridan. Franny, welcome.
Hi, Rick. Well, it's hard to mute me, so congratulations. I'm thrilled to be on your show.
Well, before I let you talk, let me say this. Miss Franny Sheridan has spent over 20 years internationally touring with her own solo theater shows based on her true family story, teaching others how to transform their true stories into written and spoken word. Her work ranges from the searingly honest and deeply dramatic to uniquely comical turns, such as her hysterical impression of her parents. Franny co-authored her first show, The Waltonsteins, in 1995, published by the International Readers Theater. It was broadcast as a radio documentary on NPR, awarded the prestigious Gabriel Award. This show attracted the legendary film director Arthur Hiller of Love Story fame to her, and they spent many years working together on a feature film version of her show. Her second solo show, Confessions of a Jewish Shiksa, Dancing on Hitler's Grave, was awarded numerous mayoral awards and accolades, and Franny's current show is called The H Word. Being produced by Next at 19th in Miami this coming Saturday, April 20th at 9 p.m. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome with me Miss Franny Sheridan. Franny, welcome.
Thank you. I can hear the thunderous applause.
I can hear it myself. Franny, what are you up to? You got a new show.
I know. I am really psyched. It's the first time I performed a solo show, but it involves many different people's stories, not just my own family story. And it's a multicultural project to boot.
I noticed that. It's lots of different cultures involved.
Yeah, and so, you know, I'm excited about it. It came out of my authentic frustration at wanting to tell my family story across cultures and boundaries, because really my family story, although I happen to be a child of two Jewish Holocaust survivors, is about pride and identity, which is, you know, relatable across all cultures and boundaries. And I was able to get my story out. It had been produced by certainly the Jewish faction and Catholics, but I realized that a lot of people felt excluded, like they felt like they didn't belong in my audience if they weren't Jewish or Catholic or something to do with religion. So I kind of dug deep into myself, you know, Rick, and I realized that that exclusion needs to stop, that feeling of exclusion. And there is, you know, a prayer that's attached to my current show, The H Word, and that is that, you know, other cultures will feel included. They'll feel that they're part of the family. I feel that, you know, all these stories, which are second-generation stories of survival of minority genocide. And, you know, I have stories from Syria. I have a story from Nigeria. I have a gay story. I certainly have second-generation Holocaust survivor stories. But there is, a universal thread to the whole thing. And, you know, that is that everybody's story of survival of being persecuted, as a member of a minority population as a result of genocide, the universal threat is that at that time they were thought of as less than human. And so the show is called The H Word because I feel that the real H word is human, and the sooner that all of us, no matter, race, religion, cultural affiliation, that we all get the fact that it's, that it is, human is a common affiliation, that, my prayer is that the sooner that these events are going to stop. And although there's, a lot of, seriousness, obviously, in the backstories that I tell, the show's interwoven with indigenous humor from each storyteller's background and, references of soul food, indigenous soul food. So it's kind of, it gets serious and then there's humor and serious and humor. So it kind of takes you on a nice little roller coaster ride. Yeah, so that's it. That's a mouthful.
Well, it sounds like an awful lot of fun. So where is Next Theater in Miami?
Next at 19th is a really charming space. It's a progressive Jewish theater spearheaded by Jenny Person, and it's located at 137 Northeast 19th Street in Miami. And, I don't know if you want me to announce where tickets and
Oh, I think you should. I mean, we've got people who are all over.
I didn't know if we were.
And it's a lovely area. Sure, go ahead.
Oh, it's great. I just didn't know if we were at that juncture yet in the conversation. But it's
listen, you're going to mention it twice, I hope.
Maybe in different languages, just to be, culturally relatable, whatever you like.
Yeah, sure.
So brownpapertickets.com is apparently where people can purchase. The tickets are $25, I think, and $20 for students, seniors, and artists. Or you can call 800-838-3006. And more information about the show is available at nextat19th.org, their website, and also my website, which is FrannySheridan.com.
Well, Franny, let me ask you this. When did you start performing? Were you one of those little kids that would grab a spoon and make it a microphone and stand in front of the mirror and entertain your invisible guests, or did you start later?
I had incremental, experiences where I forced my poor mother, who was a mother of seven kids and exhausted, to, sit and listen while my best friend Lisa Muldoon and I foisted, different theatrical performances on her. I'd actually dress up in my eldest siblings. They were identical twins in their dresses, and my best friend Lisa was almost, even then, a foot taller than me, and so the dress, the identical twins' dresses, one of them, I could get into because I'd grown into it. These were dresses from when they were little kids, but she couldn't get the zipper up. So it was sort of abusive. But I think I was, I would say I performed since I was, performing in the womb room. If you were, that would be a good name for a women's comedy club in the womb room. But I really, I majored in theater in university when I was 15 and then went to, theater college, elsewhere. And that was my journey since I was about 15 on and off doing stand-up and various solo shows. But the solo show bug really bit me in 1995 with, the creation of the Waltonsteins, which I co-authored with a fabulous playwright and director Lina Goldar Smith in Vancouver, and that completely changed my life, Rick, because I was telling a secret that I'd been brought up not to tell anyone because my parents are Jewish Holocaust survivors, and they escaped Europe by a whisker after losing after having the majority of their family and all their relatives murdered. Settled in Canada, but in 1951, after my father had established his first medical practice, he was assaulted and almost killed by an anti-Semite and his wife in his office, who were, fined the paltry sum of $30 for assault. So my dad thought, what is the point of being Jewish when, I'm going to lose yet another family, this time in Canada? So He went underground. Now, this is well before I was born because I am oh so young. But by the time I rolled around, you know, my father had converted our family from Judaism to Catholicism, anglicized our family name from Siegel to Sheridan, cut off ties with all extended family members and relocated. And so, you know, I was a little kid. Kids believe what, you know, they're told. And I thought we were just this, like, nice little Irish Catholic family. My last name's Sheridan, and we went to church every Sunday religiously. So, you know, as far as I was concerned, my, you know, childhood was perfectly Walt Disney-esque. Until one day my dad slipped up at the dinner table and said something about a Jewish, and I asked him. And, like, suddenly, you know, he began to pour out all the Holocaust stories. And my little girl world transformed into this kind of dark quagmire of, you know, Nazi stories. And I became the keeper of the Holocaustica. But it was told to me that it was a huge secret because my dad was terrified that if we revealed the truth of who we were, because that's what he was doing when he was, you know, nearly murdered in 1951, that it would get us killed. So it came out of love. You know, it came out of wanting to protect us and the fact that he had post-traumatic stress disorder, which, you know, at that time, it wasn't even coined until after Vietnam.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, you know, you have such a great sparkling personality. You clearly have your lamp turned up very high. I'm sure... just from telling, you know, these stories, you're connecting to so many people. I'm sure you have a lot of really cathartic moments with folks out in the audience.
I love it. I love it. And again, you know, it's been such a homecoming for me to perform my family story, you know, for literally, you know, 20 years internationally. And that's been so great. And now, you know, I'm so excited to bring other people's stories. Some of them want to remain anonymous. Like, some of these stories would not be told, Rick, if I didn't, you know, kind of create a forum for them. And I'm so happy to be able to do that for people and to inspire it. I also teach workshops, you know, in, like, for example, the producer, Jenny Person, has me teaching a salon to artists at the Betsy Hotel in South Beach, where she's has me put up. Sounds like I'm institutionalized, which I sort of am. But, you know, to do the show, to perform the show there next weekend. And so, like, I'm teaching a writing and, you know, basically I'm teaching how to transform personal stories into theater or other kinds of, you know, written or spoken word, memoir, to artists or, you know, a variety of people. There at the Betsy, I'm teaching that over brunch on the 19th at 10:45. You know, a few other workshops. And then I'm performing on Saturday night, which is April 20th. At 9 p.m., and it happens to be Hitler's birthday. So take that, Adolf.
Wow.
Yeah.
That must be quite a cross-cultural vibration there.
yeah.
I know you do some comedy material. You do, obviously, the serious material. Do you have a favorite, or do you like to mix it up?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. I mean, I did a lot of, you know, introspection and meditating. How could I bring humor into these works without being gratuitous? You know, because I've done stand-up comedy, and I've done Irreverent, and I've done the whole thing. But this is a different animal, and you know, I certainly am all about paying homage to the storytellers. I mean, I interviewed a lot of people for these stories, and I had to pick and choose the stories and distill it down, you know, so to edit it. So just to be clear, to answer your story, I love the fact that I can find little jewels of humor in between, but it's character-driven stuff. It's not so much shtick, although, like, for example, in my story is one of the stories. You might find that hard to believe, Rick, that I'd actually, squeeze one of my stories.
A shy, retiring wallflower like you? I can't believe it.
But, you know, so, like, in my story, you know, I talk about what I've already prefaced in our conversation here about the fact that, you know, my dad went underground after, you know, the assault in 1951, which nearly left him dead, and that, you know, he felt that, you know, when I was a little girl in Ottawa that it was important, you know, that we all kind of hide behind the veil of Catholicism, if you will, and made sure that, you know, myself and my three brothers and three sisters and my mother did the same. But my mother, who was, you know, proudly Jewish, her mother was murdered on Kristallnacht, which is the night of the broken glass in 1938. And, you know, and that's documented in a famous book called The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, My Grandmother's Murder. But anyway, so, you know, but she, my mom, really wanted to be Jewish. I mean, it wasn't, you know, just religious. It's cultural. It's a big part of food and life and laughter. And so she would rebel every now and then. Like, you know, Christmas was particularly overwhelming for her. So, you know, like she'd whip up her, you know, unique form of eggnog and, you know, and serve it to my dad, and he'd be like, "Liesl, why did you put in the eggnog? It tastes focaccia." And she'd go, "Ach, Bernie, it's delicious. Yeah, I spiked it with manischewitz." You know, and those kinds of things. And, you know, and then, you know, he'd get paranoid, and he'd say, "You know, Liesl, we have to fit in, and, you know, with the Christians, can't you make something Christmassy, you know, like fruitcake or gingerbread house?" And she'd say, "Ah, Bernie, I warn you. If you force me to make those goyish Christmas cookies like the gingerbread man, my gingerbread man would have to be circumcised." You know, and they'd have this, like, ridiculous banner, right, that would go back and forth. But, you know, I was a little kid, Rick. I had no idea. You know, first of all, they were arguing in Yiddish.
Sure.
We were raised, you know, speaking English. And secondly, you know, when you're a kid, you pretty much believe what your parents. I didn't realize they had these extremely obvious, you know, Jewish accents and mannerisms and, you know, nobody at church. And by the way, I performed the Waltonsteins, my first show in Ottawa, and many people, which is where I grew up, by the way, and many people from our community told me that they knew that we were Jewish, but it was like, you know, and I grew up, you know, in the 60s and early 70s, that they felt badly because they didn't say anything about it, but people behave differently now. I mean, I think we live in such a fabulous time in so many ways. Certainly there's a lot of darkness, but, you know, the vibration is pretty high in the world. And, you know, people, behavior-wise, are, you know, a lot more honest for better or for worse.
Sure, sure. Well, Franny, it has been a real treat having you on. Next time you come on, we're going to have to ask you to do some material, okay?
Yeah, sure. And, I just want to say it's been my absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for the interview, and keep up your good work, Rick.
Thank you, thank you.
Okay,
Hold on, you're not leaving so fast. I want you to tell our audience one more time how they can find out more about you and also how they can get tickets for the show this weekend.
Yes, certainly. Okay, well, my website is my name, FranieSherdan.com, FranieSherdan.com. And tickets are being sold at brownpapertickets.com. The number is also 800-838-3006. They're $25 and $20 for students, seniors, and artists. And the show is this coming Saturday, April 20th at 9 p.m. in Miami.
Well, thanks again, my dear. I sure appreciate you coming on. And break a leg, okay?
Thanks, Rick. Take care of yourself.
Okay,
bye-bye.
I want to hear about how the show goes. Bye-bye.
You got it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Well, that was Miss Franny Sheridan, who's putting on a one-woman show this weekend. Clearly something, if you're in the greater Dade County area, you should definitely check out. And, we're just waiting a moment for our next guest to come on. Lillian, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, then, let me play my artist intro music. Hold on one sec.
1, 2, 3, come with me, bop, and you'll be bop, in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin now with a spin, traveling in a world of my creation. What we'll see will define
what do I want to choose? Well, there's nothing to it.
That little cut is something that I think every artist builds and creates and weaves a new world for us.
That's right.
And I want to welcome you, Lillian. Lillian, my friends, Lillian. Your last name is pronounced Steinbacher?
Steinbacher.
Steinbacher.
You can call me Taylor. Lillian Taylor works.
Okay. Lillian is an extraordinary artist, graphic as well as musical, as well as an author in many, many mediums. Lillian, instead of me faking how wonderful you are in so many mediums, why don't you tell us what mediums you're working in right now?
Right now? Okay. I am singing. I'm composing a bit of music. I just got out of the studio today with a producer, kind of going over some a fit between an arrangement and some lyrics. I just finished a couple of screenplays. I am working on, I just signed a deal to have a couple of short stories published, and I'm actually illustrating a comic book, which will be then colorized, and we're going to lay voices on top of it and put a singing track behind it, and we're going to have an audio comic book.
Well, that sounds tremendous. What a great multimedia artist you are, my dear.
I'm having fun.
Well, and that's very, very important. I first met Lillian at a storytelling event, and she told the most amazing story about civil rights and her mother's incredible character. I don't know if you want to tell that story. Why don't you tell us one of your wonderful stories, Lillian?
Well, I'll tell that story.
Okay.
Okay. Let's see. You know, that was very impromptu, so hopefully I remember exactly what I was saying at the moment.
Well, so, let me set it up a little bit, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Lillian was a young girl attending school, I think, in Texas.
Actually, I remember exactly now. Then.
Okay, go ahead.
It wasn't me. It was before my time. It was my sister's.
Okay.
This is back in the 50s when there was still segregation. And my mother and sibling moved to Texas while my dad was still in the service. And he was stationed overseas in Japan at that time. And she sent her two teenage daughters to school, who were promptly then sent home because they were the wrong color. And that was just something that my mother was not going to have. So she went to the base commander and put her foot down. And she said, my husband has fought in the Korean War. He's fought the good fight in World War II. And he's still in the armed services. He is putting his life at risk for this country. And we will have every privilege of every other American, and there will be no exception to it. And I don't know what's going to have to be done about it, but it needs to be done now. And within virtually moments, the San Antonio School District was desegregated. And my children were allowed to go, my sisters were allowed to go to school with all the other kids. Well, fast forward, we lived in Denver. My mother was a school teacher, and she was insisting that there be no African-American history taught in school. Because, again, she didn't believe that we should be segregated. We are just as American as any European-American or any, maybe not as American as any Native American. But we certainly didn't need to have our own separate course in history that was an optional course, instead of being integrated into all of American history. So she fought that, and she really got pushed back so hard, even though she was a very highly educated woman. She was never allowed to advance into administration. And she was put in the worst school in Denver, in the worst neighborhood, the most dangerous circumstances for most of her career. But she was very determined as a teacher and just insisted that her students would not compromise, no matter what circumstances they came from, that they would learn, that they would not speak broken English, that they would pronounce their words properly. And when she died, this is, I think, in the summer of let me get it correct, I think it was 84. Our church was so full, it was beyond capacity. There were actually people outside who couldn't get in. And there were people who were coming up to me and telling me that because of your mother, instead of winding up being just a waste of a life, I am an engineer, for instance. The next year, when the school, or that year, later in that year, in September, finally, Denver decided that they were going to teach American history as incorporative of all Americans, instead of having African American history as a separate study. Fast forward a little bit more after my mother had passed away, and my sister actually was interviewed about the life of my mother, and that interview wound up being a part of the archives in the Smithsonian, and I am very, very proud of Audrey Fitzgerald.
Very nice. Now, you write poetry, you write short stories, you write screenplays. Obviously, you write multimedia work as well. Do you have a favorite medium, or do you enjoy writing in different ones at different times?
In terms of literature?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I was kind of thinking about that today, and I can tell you what my least favorite is. And that's writing in the screenplay form. Because as a novelist, you get to take the texture of what's around in the circumstances that you are wanting your reader to experience. The colors, the smells, the nuances of someone's makeup, for instance, and wardrobe, and all of these things have to be stripped out. That's the job of the costume department and the wardrobe department and the set designer and the director. You know, how emotions are played and portrayed. So all of that has to come out of a screenplay. So you don't get the opportunity to convey your full vision. Your work, if it incorporates those things, is not going to be considered a serious work. So you never know. I can understand why so many people have later come to say that they were very disappointed in the way that the screenplay turned out, of the book that they wrote. Because you never know whether those people are going to really understand your vision or even agree with it and have an interest in sharing it. So I found that to be a very frustrating experience. And so much of that is a part of the story, in my opinion, so that was hard. And I can't say that there's really a favorite. It's just I just get inspired. Sometimes it's just a slice of life that causes me to sit down and write a vignette, which is more of what I do than anything else, or a poem. And sometimes there's a major event, an evocative life episode, or just an inspired moment, which will spur me to do something that's a more complex structure. And then I'll get my, longer novelettes or novels out of that.
Well, let me ask you this. The recording work that you were doing today, the singing, mm-hmm. was this, were you singing your own music, or were you singing somebody else's composition?
That was mine, something I wrote probably 20 years ago. Yeah, and I took it to the most amazing man, Dominique Flores of Sonic Flesh, and he did an arrangement of it that was just way beyond anything I had envisioned. It was just so beautiful. Changed the tempo, not the tempo, we changed the pace of it, and when I first got it back, I was having a lot of difficulty with it, and I went over there and I sat with him today, and he kind of explained what his idea of it, and at first I thought I was going to have him to change this and that, and I realized how perfect it was. So I'm working on developing that, and that'll be the first piece that will be recorded for the album that I'll be working on for as long as it takes. No rush.
Great. Well, I've got a piece of your music here, the ice cream piece.
Okay.
And you want to set that up, and then we'll play it, and you can talk a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, ice cream, I actually wrote a poem. I was watching somebody in line, a whole bunch of people, in line for ice cream, and I was feeling very angry about the state of the world, and I just couldn't stand that they were, wasting their time in ice cream when everything was falling apart. And I think this is at the point in time when the guy in Norway had killed all those children who were camping. And so I wrote this very angry poem and sent it off to a producer, Spike Rebel, in Chicago, thinking it was going to be a hardcore rock, and it came back as a an R&B anthem that was very positive and very beautiful. So kudos to Spike.
What things evolve into. Okay,
yeah.
This is Ice Cream, and it's a from a poem by Lillian Taylor.
Wake up.
Lovely tune.
I have so much fun when I listen to that.
So, you've got all these irons in the fire. You have a big project you're working on. I mean, there's so many things you told us about. What's the big one you got working on? What's the one you're really counting on?
Well, counting on it. I've got this publishing deal on the comic book. It's really a big deal, I guess, because even though I enjoy drawing, and I've had a little tiny bit of training in it 8 eons ago, I'm not a real skilled artist. I just, kind of do it naturally. So I'm kind of starting some art classes so I can, kind of get it done more quickly. And then I think that's really going to be the big project, is finishing that. And I kind of want to talk a little bit about what those stories are about.
Go ahead.
This is based on these characters who are called the Shotuns and Jenna, okay, and they are little mythical features, or creatures, or I should say non-humans, who run around the world helping us humans to get over what ails us, you know, heal our broken hearts, and lead us in the right direction and protect us from dangers. But they are absolutely rambunctious and irreverent and hysterical. They just create so much havoc in the process. So they're just running around having a whole bunch of fun. And, you know, they are elements of nature that are doing this and embodied in cartoon form. And it's just so fun. They just, you know, they'll just, every time I read one of them, I just, you know, one of their little tiny episodes, I just crack up laughing. I keep myself laughing. That's really my most fun project. I think the longest term project is going to be the album. And the biggest thing that I finally brought to the finish line, and the only thing I really actually brought to the finish line, was the screenplays. And that was just a monumental undertaking. It wound up being three, so a mini series, coming out of a book, and I had absolutely no intention of writing it, but I'm so happy I wound up with actually a writing coach to get it finished. And so shopping that, and I think, well, hopefully be the first thing that actually, you know, gives me legitimacy as a working artist.
That's wonderful.
Thanks.
Now, I know you have a website. Is that something you want to share with our audience?
Sure. So I think of my work a lot as art tripping on things that are about nature and about human nature. So art tripping on Gaia is where the concept came from. So it's Artripaia, Artripaia, Artripaia.com. And so please go and enjoy a little bit of my music and a little bit of the writing and some of the drawings and the photography and read a little bit about me. And send me an email.
Okay. let's see. We've got just a couple minutes left.
Okay.
Is there anything else you want to talk to the audience about? How you found your voice or what motivates you to write?
What motivates me? Well, you know, it's just, I think I've heard so many different artists say exactly what I experience, is that it just comes. It's not like I go out there and choose it. You know, sometimes it'll just, something like lightning striking, and then everything else has to be put aside. And it doesn't matter what it is, and I'm sorry about the deadline, but I'm just captured by something, and it's got to get down right now because I can't lose it. It can be 3 o'clock in the morning, and I have to get out of bed and turn on, you know, the equipment and record those sounds I just heard, because I know if I wait till morning, it'll be absolutely lost. So it's just an inspiration that comes from someplace else. And, you know, and again, in writing the screenplay, yeah, I've been very disciplined in my life about intellectual pursuits and, you know, my work ethic and things like that, but I've never really had to do that with art. And I found that in writing a screenplay, I actually had to take those disciplines and kind of impose it on my art, which I thought was not going to be, you know, fun. It's a very different process to just be inspired by something and just let it flow out than to have to sit down and force creativity because there needs to be, you know, someone says there needs to be a segue between this moment and, you know, that thing over there, and for it to make sense to, you know, the third party visually. And so, you know, just trying to figure out a structure for that was an interesting build. So, you know, it can come from different places, but I think the most organic and natural one, what I enjoy most of all, is when it just, you know, a chord strikes me because I see something that's just, like, too wrong in the world. Or so absolutely astonishingly beautiful, or just hysterical. And,
well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so very much, Lillian. I'm glad you could come on and talk to us a little bit about your work.
It was my pleasure.
Keep up the good work.
I will do that.
And thanks for introducing us to the next guest who will be coming on in just a moment. Thanks again, Lillian. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. And ladies and gentlemen, before I bring on our next guest, Beatrice Malnick of Brazilian Voices, let me use my little artist introductory music.
One, two, three, come with me, bop, and you'll be bop, in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see into your imagination.
Wow, that was a little draggy. Let me go ahead and bring Beatrice on. Good evening, Beatrice. Welcome.
Hi, Rick. How are you doing?
Very good, very good. It's such a wonderful thing to have you on. I'm a huge fan of Brazilian music, and you have an ensemble called, is it Brazilian Voices?
Brazilian Voices, yes. And here today I am with Lauren Oliveira, the co-director of our group. So
hi, Lauren.
Here with us too.
Hi, Lauren. Welcome.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you for having us.
Well, it's our pleasure. A good friend of ours, Lillian Taylor, recommended you, and I'm so pleased you could join us. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the group Brazilian Voices?
All right. Yeah, we were formed. We started in 2001. It was a result of a vocal technique workshop for Brazilian talents, mostly. And at the end of this workshop, we offered them the opportunity to perform a couple or three Brazilian songs at a performance, and the results, the audience responded so well to this performance, so we decided to continue as a regular vocal group. And so now we are 40 singers, most of them Brazilian, but we have American singers, we have singers from Colombia, Argentina, Venezuela. And they love to sing in Portuguese. That this is what ties us together. And in 2005, we became a non-profit organization. And so we work in different areas. We have right now four departments. We have the cultural department, where we perform shows in different venues, most of here in Florida, but also we went to New York, we went to Spain already, to Mexico. We have the other department called Educational Department, where we perform for public schools, for children, elementary and middle school. We have our Arts and Healing Department, where we perform in hospitals and nursing homes. We're going to talk about this later. And we also have the Brazilian Voices Kids and Teens. So we have different departments doing different activities, always using our voices.
Now, Lourdes, you want to say something?
Lauren?
No, I'm just laughing here because it sounds like a lot of work.
Well, it is, but I tell you what, it's worth it, I'm sure. One of the premises of tonight's show, normally this show is very politically oriented, talking about how people are working to make this a better world for the environment, or a better world to work in, or a better place to live, or a better place for healthcare, or for the environment. But I wanted to focus just at least once in a while on the work of artists to make this a better world. The arts, whether it be a painting or a dance or music, has such power to help people, to heal people. And I wanted to salute that in artists. Let me play one of the music pieces that you sent me, and I'll let you talk about it after we listen to it, okay?
Perfect. Thank you, Rick.
Okay, great. Here we go. Oh, I'm sorry. Evidently, the internet is dragging today, and the music, I'd rather not play it than have it play badly. Let me ask you this, the Brazilian music that you sing, is it traditional popular music, traditional music, or is it music that you are writing yourselves?
Yeah, we have different themes for our concerts. We started with the Brazilian jazz, or the bossa nova. Our first CD that was released in 2005 was mostly Brazilian jazz, bossa nova, some sambas. But we have different themes, so we do Brazilian pop, we do classical Brazilian, Villa Lobos, and we do Brazilian rock. So it depends on the theme, but we try to do a little bit of everything, all the influences. In November of last year, we did mostly samba and some rhythm, African rhythms, Brazilian, that they are now Brazilian.
Do you have any performances coming up?
Yes, yes, we have one coming in May 10th at the Broward Center for the Performing Arts. It's a Friday. It's called Lounge Brazil.
Ooh, that sounds nice.
The subtitle is The Best of Bossa Nova.
I have, I don't know if you're familiar with the internet service called Pandora.
Oh, and, yeah. We are,
love
we,
it.
The channel that I listen to most is Astrid Gilberto and Gilberto Gil, or Gaetano Veloso. I absolutely love Brazilian music. I do a lot of programming, and I love to program to samba and bossa nova.
Oh, thank you, Rick. Thank you for promoting our music and the culture exchange as well. This is very important. We truly believe on that.
Well, the show in Broward on the 10th, where would people go to get tickets for that?
At the Broward Center, if you go to www.browardcenter.org or our site also www.brazilianvoices.org, you can find, I have here the number also for the box office if you want.
Sure.
The box at the Broward Center is 954-462-2222. So here you can find our tickets to Lounge Brazil.
And what time is that show?
8:30 p.m.
That sounds really wonderful. Let me try one more time to get this to play. It was working perfectly earlier, but a lot of times on Sunday evenings, if the internet gets too busy, this music doesn't play very well. Let me try it again.
Okay.
I'm going to stop that. It's starting to drag. Oh, that is so lovely. I'm really looking forward to seeing you all perform. Now, let me ask you this. Sometimes some singing groups have dancers. I thought maybe especially with a cultural group like this, do you do some Brazilian dancing as well, or is it strictly just a musical group?
It is a music group. Because we train different singers from amateurs, most of them with different backgrounds. So we train the singers, but dancers we use mostly when we do our educational program from Brazil to the world, that we're able to show different music from different regions in Brazil and the typical dance from different regions. So we do use a lot of dancers, especially capoeira, which it is the Brazilian martial arts.
Sure.
Do you know, Rick, capoeira?
Oh, yes. Yes, I've heard of it.
But we use a lot of, with the beating bow sound. So we show different instruments that we use in Brazil. But capoeira and dancers, we always try to bring out, the beauty of dance also, because it's so inspiring, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this. When, Beatrice, what... what got you involved? Did you sing since you were young? What got you both involved in the musical life?
Oh, yes. I'm going to talk about myself, and then Lauren can talk about her. Yes,
that's
I
great.
Have, I was a pianist since the age of nine.
Uh-huh.
I always performed in choirs. I entered the music university in São Paulo, and I performed with different Brazilian artists like Toquinho. He's known in Brazil and Italy. Chico Buarque and Roberto Menescal, other Brazilian composers. You know,
uh-huh.
So I was touring with them and always working with different vocals. I love to do the vocal arrangements that we sing.
Oh, my goodness.
And Lauren also, she's very creative. So both together, we really, really, you know, we are able to go far in what we want to do.
So you both do arranging as well?
Yes, we arrange the voices. All the,
oh,
the voices,
oh, nice,
that you hear is our arrangement.
I am a former trumpet player, and when I was I started studying very young myself. It's in second grade, and I had the good fortune to do some arrangements for some jazz bands in high school and early college. I love arranging. It allows you to do so much with the instrumental voicings, and with bossa nova, oh, it's just
easy to make arrangements. They have a good sequence of harmony, beautifully, you know, composers like Tom Jobim that composes so well. It's so easy to make these arrangements,
yeah,
you know.
Caetano Veloso
and all of you.
Gilberto Gil. Yeah.
So are there both men and women in your choir?
No, it's a female vocal group, Rick.
Oh, just male?
Female.
Female. Ah, even lovelier. Let me see.
So you can imagine how our rehearsals are, you know, very, very lively, talkative.
Talk a lot, and once in a while we sing.
Yeah, I was going to say, who's the sound,
either talking or singing.
who's the rough taskmaster that gets everybody to stand still and sing?
Oh, we alternate, right? Yeah.
Good cop,
bad
cop.
Yeah, we have some people to help us. No, but, you know, it is serious, and when it's time to sing, and we always, in these performances, we count, you know, with great, great musicians. We always have great musicians accompanying us. This performance, Lounge Brazil, we're going to have the presence of Nestor Torres.
Oh, I know Nestor.
The flute player, you know, probably you know him.
Yeah.
He's going to perform 3 songs with us. And also the presence of Eric Paredes. He's a DJ, so he came with different ideas of grooves. And Jorge Sosa, a great, great musician that accompanies Nestor in most of his performances.
Excellent.
He is amazing. He's organized. So when it's time to sing, we really sing.
Yeah.
Well, let me try one more time to get some music up, okay? Hold on one second.
Thank you, Rick.
Here we go. I think this will work.
This Rick?
There we go. Well, at least we managed a little bit of it, huh?
Yeah, Sergio Mendes and Black Eyed Peas, we love that. We use that song in the opening of our educational programs. It's the first song of From Brazil to the World. We love it.
I know. My among my many, many favorites are The Waters of March and Little Boat. They're just such beautiful, beautiful tunes.
Yeah, Waters of March. We're going to be performing that song May 10th and April 10th for the Performing Arts of Arts Week. I hope you're going to be able to go.
I'm going to do my absolute utmost. And since the month of May is what I call the month of Linda, my wife and I will be celebrating our 43rd anniversary in May. And I think I'm going to bring her to the show.
That'll be wonderful.
That's
Ray.
Great.
Awesome. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. She's a wonderful woman, and I'm a very happy man. So,
that's great.
So, let's see. I had a chance to hear from Beatrice. Lourdes, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself?
Oh, I also started earlier, but mostly with musicals in Brazil. I did a Vida, Hair, kind of Broadway style, more like theater. And I traveled to, you know, many countries, and I started recording with different artists. Actually, Beatriz and Monique and myself, we study with same vocal trainers in Brazil. We work with same producers. But we met here in Weston, in South Florida, for the first time. Yeah, we start putting together some, you know, Acoustic Brazil group and singing Bossa Nova. And after that, we decided to do this workshop that became a Brazilian Voices, the vocal female vocal group. But anyways, mostly it was like theater, drama, and self-expression. So I can help, you know, also with production. I do production in Brazilian Voice as well, so I can help them, you know, to set up the stage and to put together different teams of production.
Sure.
So the singers can just, you know, be there, shine beautiful, and you know, spread art and love through music. So it's
there's
a good combination. Our team is fantastic. We have great directors, great coordinators for different departments, programs. So I hope you enjoy May 10th.
Oh, absolutely. Are there any other shows? Do you have any other shows across Florida? Because this show is heard across Florida. Do you have any shows in Tampa, Orlando, points north?
Not yet. Hopefully after your program, we'll be able to have some shows in Tampa, Orlando.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. So for people who want to get in touch with you, they're going to get in touch with you through BrazilianVoices.org.
Yes,
right?
And you can send us an email to info@BrazilianVoices.org.
Okay. And I imagine you have both a website, a Facebook site as well?
Yes.
Yes, we do.
Well, I know a lot of people that are going to be liking it as of tonight and tomorrow, that's for sure.
Oh, that's great.
My goodness. Let's see. My goodness. What else can I ask? How many voices do you have in that? Did you say 40 people?
40 people, yes. 40 women, yes. And so right now we have 15 kids and teens.
Oh, how nice.
So around 60 altogether.
That's great. So do you do performances at the schools as well?
In the schools, in public schools, yes.
In the hospitals.
In the hospitals. For the hospitals, we go in a group of six to eight singers. We sing in the patients' rooms. We sing in different parts of the hospital.
Memorial, Miramar Hospital, Sylvester Cancer Center, Covenant Village. We go to different pre-surgery and...
Yeah, post-surgery, pre-surgery, the infusion, chemotherapy infusion.
So we take Bossa Nova, but a very smooth week. Is not
Oh,
like,
good stuff. Absolutely.
Like
well, ladies, you have a new friend here.
It's very smooth, very joyful Bossa Nova repertoire. And the singers, they have to go through a workshop to study exactly, to have simulations and how to have this approach with patients, staff, caregivers. So the intention is to really, you know, bring some music, hope, and joy into this the hospital's environment.
Well, I'll tell you what. I understand that you have a CD available also.
Yes, we have some CDs.
Well, how
we
can
have,
you buy your CDs,
CD,
ladies? Come on.
The first CD we released is in the stores or most
maybe
of the
through
stores.
Amazon?
And then we have other CDs of the different themes that we perform. So we
okay.
have a total around 6 CDs.
Oh, that's fantastic. Ladies, thank you so much for joining me. I will definitely be seeing you May 10th down
Yay.
At the...
8:30 p.m. It's a Friday, so it's a good day.
Oh, Friday's a great
for
day
for everybody
that.
To come.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't... Luckily, it's not Sunday night.
Yes, because Sunday, this Sunday is going to be Mother's Day, so...
Well, happy Mother's Day to you, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you so much,
my
Rick.
Linda, your wife.
Well, my pleasure, and we'll. I want to talk to you again soon, and I'll see you on the 10th.
Great,
thank
you. Bye-bye.
Thanks
bye.
Again.
Thank
bye-bye.
Bye.
So that was Beatrice and Lourdes from the Brazilian Voices organization. Check it out. Definitely you want to get their CDs. Brazilian music is so good for you. And now, ladies and gentlemen, by special arrangements with the comedian himself, Mr. Lee Camp, I'm going to play you some very, very pointed political humor from the comedian Lee Camp, who's got a wonderful show and lots of content up on the web. Check him out. This isn't for the kiddies, but it's for big grown-up people who know what's going on here. And I want to thank all our guests tonight for joining us. And let's see here. We'll get Mr. Camp's work up here in just a second. My goodness here. Let's see. Let me put on Paul Robeson for a minute while I find Mr. Camp.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, and standing by my bed, they framed you on a murder charge. Says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. It's more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling near his eyes, says Joe, what hate can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, there you find your hill. You're 10 years dead. I never died.
Robeson, human rights activist, civil rights activist, and incredible talent. This show is a salute to the artists that change the world every day. And here is Lee Camp with his piece called The XL Pipeline.
We got no plans, no plans at all. Evil man's always transcending. Fight her like sheep, swallow everything. Always simpletons or pretending.
This is your moment of clarity from LeeCamp.net. I'm sure you heard about the Exxon oil spill in Mayflower, Arkansas the other day. The original Mayflower ship explored new territory. And in a way, so is this oil spill, because it's one of the first tar sands oil spills in the U.S. And we're learning how hard it is to clean up this shit. I love learning new things, don't you? So the heads of these oil companies, I'll call them psychopathic butthole-faced greed monkeys, or PBGMs for short, make billions of dollars a year for their companies. These companies also get subsidies from the taxpayers to the tune of anywhere between $10 and $50 billion. Then, when asked to pay taxes back to the society they've pillaged, the PBGMs look at us as if we've asked them to spend a weekend bathing the homeless. According to Citizens for Tax Justice, between 2008 and 2010, ExxonMobil paid a tax rate of 0.4%. That's less taxes than Snoop Dogg paid on his medicinal marijuana stash. Then when they spill oil across a town like Mayflower, they do a great job of pretending to clean it up. With big paper towels and funny hats and hoses, they put on quite a little show. And why do I consider it a show? Because there's a deep, dark secret about oil that the PBGMs really don't want you to know. You can't clean up oil. You can't do it. Not really. Not in the real world. Not when it's mixed with water and soil and otters. It's fucking impossible. You can clean up some of it. You can push it around a little. You can get it out of people's fucking faces. But it ain't gonna magically subtract itself from the water and land. So what Exxon and BP do is they make it look like they're cleaning up. Just like it looks like that magician ripped the head off the bunny rabbit. Just like it looks like that guy punted that football across a fucking highway and into a basketball hoop in that viral video that got 12,743,000 more views than this video will ever get. Did any of those things really happen? Nope. But it's all part of the show, my friends. Exxon should win an Oscar for best performance by a corporation in a dark, dark comedy. And even though they put on a show, they would prefer you don't see the spill at all. And this is why BP held the media back from the Gulf of Mexico, even going to the trouble of hiding oil-covered dolphin carcasses, which is really a specialty skill. Not many colleges even allow you to major in that anymore. It's got to be a labor of love. And Exxon has fought the media back from this news spill. They even went so far as to get the FAA to declare a no-fly zone over the spill. You know, there were only three other events in our history that were so gruesome the authorities wouldn't even allow planes to fly overhead. 9/11, the eviction of Occupy, and last year's Adam Sandler film, That's My Boy. But luckily, Exxon's now telling us this wasn't an oil spill. They're telling us they spilled something else called bitumen, which sounds like how Snoop Dogg would describe his weed. But no, bitumen is chemicals mixed with Canadian tar sands. It's even more toxic than oil. And the Koch brothers and TransCanada and Exxon and so many others are salivating at the idea of pumping this shit across the entire continental U.S. in the new tar sands pipeline, a.k.a. the Keystone XL, a.k.a. the nail in the coffin for climate change. A rupture from the Keystone pipeline would make this current spill look like wiping dog shit off the bottom of your shoe. Bitumen is a vicious motherfucker, and it's not going to be cleaned up by a quicker picker-upper. Wait a second, I thought we were talking about oil. How do we get to climate change? A good person to ask about that would be NASA scientist James Hansen, who has told us for years that the tar sands contain twice the amount of carbon dioxide emitted by global oil use in our entire history. And if we fully exploit them, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would be truly catastrophic, killing off between 20 and 50% of the planet's species. And for those of you who think you don't care about this, it would also probably ruin your bachelor party. I hope that celebratory blow-up doll also works as a raft, because your town will likely be underwater. So what can you do about this other than protest the Keystone XL and throw things at your TV? Well, there's actions going on everywhere, every day. My friend Ed Fallon in Iowa has a cool one. He's doing a march for climate action across the entire United States. Some say marches never do anything. I point them to the Civil Rights Marches and the Vietnam War Marches and the march that Snoopy does every Thanksgiving Day down the streets of Manhattan to raise money for erectile dysfunction research. Of course, it was revealed last year that someone just forgot to inflate that part of Snoopy's body. So maybe that example isn't the best. Anyway, you can learn more about the march at climatemarch.org. And tell the Keystone Pipeline to go fuck itself before it fucks all of us. That's been your Moment of Clarity from LeeCamp.net. If you don't always have time to watch the MOC videos, you can listen to it on my podcast. You'll get the rants for free right into your head holes, these head holes. I'll put the link to the iTunes page in the description below, and you can also get my podcast on Stitcher and Android app. Thanks a lot. Keep fighting.
No plans at all. Evil man's always transcending. Fight her like she swallow everything. Always simpletons or pretending.
That's Lee Camp with his Moment of Clarity. I want to just tell you a couple more news stories. By the way, don't forget, these shows are brought to you by Imagineering Productions. If you need computer support, graphics, multimedia, animation, web media, or web marketing, please give Imagineering a call. And if you're interested in sponsorship, please let us know. Under the heading of Ask Me No Questions, the Obama administration's new nominee to lead the Environmental Protection Agency declined on Thursday to answer questions about a controversial new guide that suggests that public health standards could be relaxed dramatically in the event of a nuclear attack or accident. Asked to comment on concerns that the guide references clean water guidelines nearly 30,000 times less stringent than the EPA rules, Gina McCarthy remained silent following her Senate confirmation hearing. An aide said, no comment, and pushed a reporter out of the way. Called a protective action guide for radiological incidents, the new document references International Atomic Energy Agency guidelines, suggesting that intervention is not needed until drinking water is contaminated with radioactive iodine-131 at a concentration of 81,000 picocuries per liter. That's 27,000 times less stringent than the EPA rule of 3 picocuries. Okay, so they're adjusting the allowable rate of radioactivity from 3 picocuries to a new level of 81,000 picocuries. Sounds like they're getting ready to notice we're getting radioactivity, doesn't it? This document has created an uproar among watchdog groups and is now also attracting attention on Capitol Hill, according to congressional aides with knowledge of the issues. The staffer has asked to remain anonymous due to not being authorized to discuss the matter, but he told Global Security Newswire that lawmakers are looking at the issue for purpose of commenting in more detail at a later date. Previously, an EPA spokesperson noted that the guide would be subject to a 90-day public comment period once it's formally published in the Federal Register. The document, which was posted on the EPA's website Friday evening. You know, Friday, that's when they announce things that they'd rather you didn't think about. Friday evening, the Friday evening announcement, one more time, Friday evenings when they announce things that you do not know about. Some activists have blamed McCarthy for various controversies surrounding the development of a new guide, which was under her purview as the agency's assistant administrator for air and radiation. They've argued the document's not fundamentally different from a prior version drafted by the Bush administration, except, you know, it's 27,000 times more available of radiation. McCarthy's confirmation hearing on Thursday consisted largely of partisan disputes between Republicans concerned about the prospect of tougher air and climate standards, I don't think I have anything to worry about there, and Democrats who argued that such measures need consideration. Senate Environment and Public Works Committee Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. Tune in and check out our show next week. It is a Fukushima show. Lots of information you need to be aware of. Just because it's on the other side of the Pacific, they have brought the Pacific radiation home to you. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much. Rick Spisak, News Director, Progressive News Network. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.